Hello again, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the First 11. It's our weekly soccer podcast. We'll cover the sport around the world, here in our country, and just about any place they're playing this sport, anywhere around the world. Last week, we detailed what a busy spring and summer it's going to be, and we'll try to keep you current on some of what's happening. I'm Bill McDermott. I'll be your host as we take this weekly trip together. First 11, by the way, is brought to you by Bud Light, Game Day's favorite light lager and famous among friends. All of our content is available on camox.com/soccer, camox.com/soccer, as we broadcast from the studios of CamOX, America's sports voice, and our executive producer is Ben Boyd. Our first guest today just returned from a March camp with the United States national team, games against Ecuador and Chile. It is now back with Fulham. We welcome to the First 11, Tim Ream. Tim, thank you very much for joining us. How you been?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me, Bill.
Well, let's get the unpleasantness out of the way right here at the outset. A loss to Watford on April 2nd sealed, unfortunately, Fulham's fate, relegation. And what I'm interested in, Tim, is that you were very outspoken. You said the team lacked togetherness, a unity, a desire, a passion. Do you think your teammates got the message?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I think that's been our Achilles heel all season. And I did an interview early in the season just after coming back from injury in the beginning of the year when we were struggling, and said the same thing. So we'll see here. We have five games. We can either go the same way we've been going, or we can kind of prove to people that we've been underperforming as a team and as a group, and hopefully, guys will kind of step up and be a bit better.
And Tim, what you just said, I think one of the key words is underperforming, because some of your games I've watched, for the first 45 minutes, you were world beaters. And then from out of nowhere, the level just fell off.
Yeah, it's definitely a lack of concentration from front to back and back to front, however you want to look at it, depending on what your viewpoint is as a fan and as a spectator. You look at some of the matches that we played, more so recently, we've gone toe to toe with Liverpool, we've gone toe to toe with Chelsea, and had decent performances, and for whatever reason, a mistake happens, a goal goes in, and heads drop, and confidence is just gone, and we just seem to kind of crumble from there, which is not the best attribute in this league, and with the type of players that you're going up against every week.
Tim, you got your professional start with the New York Red Bulls and MLS in 2010 after a career at St. Louis University. Do you think, Tim, that your experience in intercollegiate soccer, did it prepare you for MLS play?
For me personally, yes. I look at some of these kids that are being signed through the academies now, and I don't think at 15, 16, 17 years old that I was anywhere near ready to be a professional. Mm-hmm. And for myself, I don't think that I could have chosen a different path. I think the path that I've gone, be it as rare as it is nowadays, was definitely the path that set me up for the most success. Mm-hmm. Playing, four seasons at St. Louis U was, it prepared me, and it helped me grow as a person, as a professional, in order to succeed in MLS. And mm-hmm. obviously, I don't think you can argue with my first 2 years. I mean, played every minute of every single game that my rookie year, and that's not done.
That is
too much these
that's
days.
Exceedingly rare, Tim, and I'm glad you brought that up about your experiences with the Red Bulls, because your coach at the time, Hans Bach, I remember him saying words to this effect that Tim has a distinct chance to be a national team player. He's calm. He's comfortable in possession. He's never stressed. So, first of all, the good news, he was indeed prophetic. But more importantly, Tim, did he put you in position to become a better player?
You know what? I think the group that they put together in New York, and that includes myself, put me in a position to become a better player. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it helps having a European type. I say type, but he was definitely European. You know, a European style of play. It wasn't just let's hit the ball, you know, play long ball and work off second balls. It was, you know, let's possess the ball, let's move the ball. And, you know, that's a product of the guys we had in New York. I mean, you had, obviously, Thierry Henry comes in halfway through the year, Rafa Marquez, Teemu Taino, I mean, Carl Robinson. I mean, all these guys have played in Europe and played at big teams. So, you know, there was a distinct style of play that they wanted to play, and I happened to fit that bill, thankfully. And, you know, and I played my part well and was able to keep the spot in the starting 11 all throughout the season.
Mm-hmm. Tim, I mentioned when we began our conversation about the most recent games against Ecuador and Chile. That was your first cap since 2017. The Ecuador game wasn't. You played at a back four with Tyler Adams and John Brooks and Aaron Long. That seemed to be a good, comfortable grouping for you.
Yeah, it was. Although, you know, playing at left back, it was a little bit different for me. Obviously, playing center back now the last, solely playing center back the last, you know, 2.5 seasons. But, you know, I had good conversations with Greg and what he wanted out of his left back, and the way he wants his right back to kind of invert in and almost play as another center midfielder, and we almost become the left back and two center backs almost become three at the back in possession. It just kind of fit the style of play and my style. You know, he's not looking for a guy to go bombing forward, but we had. I mean, I didn't fly in until the Monday evening. I had a Tuesday little bit involved with the session, and really only had a full session with all the guys on the Wednesday before the Ecuador game. So to take on board all those, you know, all four of us, what Greg wanted in such a short amount of time and have it look fairly comfortable and the communication be what it was like you said, it was a comfortable back four, and we all kind of knew our roles and fit the roles perfectly.
As a direct follow-up to what you just commented on, Tim, the inevitable question presents itself. What is your preference, center back or a wide back?
No, I've gotten this question my entire career.
And so here's another one.
I just want to be on the field. You know, if he's looking for a left back to bomb on and get up and down the line and overlap and do all that, that's probably not my not my forte. If that's what is going to be called for in a game, then someone else is probably better suited for the job. And I'd say a center back, but you know, I quite like being out there, being out at left back in his system, and the way, you know, he wanted to play and, you know, he spelled out all the options that I would have on the ball at every single, you know, moment. And it was, you know, it was nice. You know, I didn't feel uncomfortable. And, you know, in years past, under previous coaches, playing left back has almost been a nightmare for me. But, you know, like I said, it felt comfortable. And, you know, I want to be on the field. So if that's the style and that's the system he's going to play, I'm happily, you know, happy to play left back. And that goes back to my original answer. I just want to play.
Just put me in the first 11. Tim, you mentioned Greg Berhalter. Obviously, we're talking about the new national team coach. It's a big transition for the team. A new coach, a new model, different style, big gaps, immense gaps sometimes between games. How do you think Greg's doing early in this process?
You know, I've been really, really impressed with the amount of communication that he has with us as players and as individuals, as just people. I had multiple phone conversations with him and his assistants before even coming into camp. I had, you know, a video session, a Skype session, but I was able to, you know, look at video clips of the January camp games and what his ideas and what he wanted to impart on the program and on the squad. And like I said, I've been impressed. You know, they throw a lot of information at all of us, and it was a lot. It's a lot of information in a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. But guys have really taken to it and really grasped the ideas, and really just run with them. And we're just trying to do exactly what he wants to do. And at this point, everyone's just trying to please Greg and what he wants. And I think, you know, if we work for each other and work for him, you know, there's no telling what we can do, as a program.
Tim, a question with reference, a further question about the national team, in particular about one of your teammates. Anyone who follows the sport knows that whoever wears the 10 shirt for his country has to meet high expectations. How do you think Christian Pulisic is handling those expectations so far as a very young player?
You know, not a lot phases him. But I think you can say that a lot about a lot of these, 18, 19, 20-year-old kids. And I call them kids. They're obviously not kids, but compared to myself, I've been around the block and I've seen, seen kids come and go and have kids hyped up and all of a sudden they drop off the map and you never hear from them again. So for Christian, he's just kind of living in the moment. You know, he knows he's a top talent. You know, you don't play at Dortmund regularly if you're not a very, very good player. Mm-hmm. And you don't get bought by Chelsea if you're not a very, very good player. So I don't think he's looking any further than right now. He's focused on continuing to improve as a player and improve as a teammate. The international game is a very different game. You know, you can get away with dribbling by a few guys in Germany, dribbling by a few guys in England, but international level, I mean, he's got a target on his back, and I think sometimes he gets frustrated that he has that target, and they do catch him on the ankles, on the toes, hard fouls, but that's the way the game goes, and. You know, I think he's learning to deal with that, and as he gets older, he'll learn even more and continue to improve in his frustrations.
Yeah. Furthermore, Tim, about a national team camp with the current crop, you alluded to this, of young players who have played at a high level at a very youthful level, it's got to be next to impossible with that overall depth of quality to select a 23 or 24 man camp.
Yeah, I mean, I don't envy that job. I don't know that I envy any manager's job to select 11, and then select a 23 and then have to select 11 from that. You look at the number of again 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds that are playing at high levels throughout Europe now. And even the guys who are playing in MLS, are one and two, probably the best on their MLS teams. Mm. It can't be easy. I don't envy, being the coach and having to pick a 23, because inevitably you're going to have guys who think that they should be involved and they think they should, be included in the squads and wanting to start and play in every match. Unfortunately, that's not the case. That doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. As hard as it is, it's such a cutthroat. It's a cutthroat job, and it is. It's a job. You go out and you have to perform, and if you don't perform, there's someone right there waiting to to step over you. So, you know, rightfully so, guys are going to be disappointed that, they think they should be involved. But at the same time, you know, they need to then reach out, because Greg's phone is always, you know, his door is always open, his phone's always on, and see what they need to do to be picked.
A little bit more about Coach Berhalter, Tim, in particular about style. He seems to like the two center backs, a foundation of maybe two or three players right in front of the center backs. I guess as a former defender, you've kind of touched upon this. That's a good starting point for your defense.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, any good team is, you know, is built on a solid foundation, starting at the back, and you want to have a solid core, and not just core as in, you know, 3, 4, 5, you know, 6 really strong players or 6 key players. You want to have that spine, that core down the middle, and the more you can keep teams wide, and not, you know, cutting you through the middle, the better off you're going to be. I think it's a lot easier to deal with crosses as center backs, as defenders, than it is, you know, guys dribbling at you, turning in between, you know, the midfield and the defense and running at you. And, you know, then you're basically running back towards your own goal, just trying to make sure someone, you know, gets there soon enough to help you. So he's definitely got a very specific, you know, system in the middle, and that's to make sure that balls don't come into the middle easily, and to keep things wide, and we deal with it from there. And so far, so good. You know, we worked on it a lot in March, and I think they worked on it even more so in January, when, you know, when they have 3 to 4 weeks to really drill into what they want to do.
Tim, when we first started our conversation, I mentioned you got your start at MLS with the Red Bulls, then Bolton, now Fulham. Would you ever envision returning to Major League Soccer?
Yeah, I think at some point I have this conversation again more so lately than a few years ago, but it's one of those that I never close a door. You know, doors are always open, and I always leave them open until, you know, another door looks better to me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I can't say that I would never come back. For me personally, I'm enjoying, even though this season has been tough, I'm enjoying playing over here. I'm enjoying the pressure, the cutthroatness of, you know, having relegation, having promotion. You know, it's just, I thrive on that type of pressure. And I think for me personally, I'll stay over as long as there are teams, championship, mid table championship, higher that want me to play and play a role and you know, play games. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, there's nothing on the cards in the immediate future, but like I said, I'll never say never.
Last question before we let you go, Tim. No trip to Craven Cottage is complete without a trip to McBride's Bar. People still talk about Brian McBride over at Craven.
All the time. Yeah, all the time. I mean, I think I see more Americans, and when we have to do appearances after games, you know, we have to go into McBride's Bar sometimes, and I honestly, there are more Americans in there than Brits, because they want to be and see and just they love Brian.
Mm-hmm.
As we all do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's not to love about him? But yeah, I mean, people still say, oh, we started following Fulham when McBride was here. You know, he really started the full America, really, with the way he was scoring goals and the way he, you know, put himself about and just ran through brick walls.
Mm-hmm.
But that's Brian, wasn't it?
I mean, yeah, it certainly was.
Plates in his face and cuts, and, you know, he would run through anything to win and get a result.
Well, it was first Brian McBride, then Clint Dempsey, now Tim Ream with Fulham. Tim, thank you very much for your time. All the best to the family. Hello to Kristen. Get those troublesome middle kids to bed. Sorry we took away from sleep time. And continued success with the national team, Tim. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
And the First 11 is brought to you by Bud Light, Game Day's favorite light lager and famous among friends. Our second guest today is likewise a United States national team player. Granted, a different era than Tim Ream, but also during his tenure, he was captain of the United States national team. And prior to turning pro in the NASL, the North American Soccer League, he played on the 1972 United States Olympic team. And by the way, won the Herman Trophy in 1969 and 1970, playing at St. Louis University. Formerly known as Captain America, a teammate of mine, Al Trost joins us on the First 11. Al, thank you very much for being with us. How are you?
Hi, Bill. I'm doing very good.
Well, thank you for your time. Now, in full disclosure, I must tell our listeners that I played on the 1969 NCAA championship team with Al at St. Louis University. And I mention that just to get some clarification. Al, it cannot be 50 years since that game, can it?
I know, that's awful, isn't it? Those are some of the greatest friendships that we'll ever have, that's for sure.
Oh, Spartan Stadium in San Jose. Little did I know, Al, that when we left the field that particular day, that I'd be back there broadcasting the inaugural MLS game between the San Jose Clash and D.C. United.
Wow.
Al, we wanted to get your input as a former national team player because, as I mentioned, we had Tim Ream on early. Current national team member. And first of all, your opinion so far, it's very early in his career as national team coach, but your opinion as what you've seen so far from Greg Berhalter as the national team coach.
Oh, I'm excited. I really like the player selections. I think the world of some of the young players he's played in the pool so far. I'm excited for these guys. I think they're going to do very well in the next World Cup.
And, you know, Al, we talked with Tim Ream, and we asked him the inevitable question, center back or wide back, and what would be your preference? Where would you like to see Tim Ream in the First 11?
I would like to see him attacking at the wide back. I think he's got that kind of skill. So, but watching him play in the middle back, he's comfortable there too, and he really doesn't make many mistakes, if any at all.
No, we talked with him about that, Al. Yeah, his coach Hans Bakken, when he came with the Red Bulls, was overly effusive with praise about his balls out of the backfield on the ground. You are immediately out of the back in the attack. You got a 30 or 40-yard ball on the ground inside the center circle. You're off to the races.
Yeah, and I think Tim can do that very well. It's just it's unfortunate what's happened over in Fulham, though. I've been following that ever since he joined them, and I wish they could have stayed up in the Premier League, but it's very unfortunate.
Al, I remember one of our prior conversations that you mentioned how much you like Tyler Adams after seeing him play early in his career. How's he progressing?
I like the way he plays. I think he stuck out in a few of the games I saw him play, and I'm seeing more and more of the younger players. I'm just really excited about the youth in the program. That's outstanding.
And Tim alluded to that, Al, about all the young players who have been playing at a fairly high level, either at academy or various national youth teams. When they get into national team camp, they are no longer in awe. They're ready to play.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. Kind of a little bit unlike when we were when I started with the national team program back in the early 1970s, or late 1970s. It's been quite revolutionary here.
Revolutionary is the word, and we're going to talk about your national team career. But in the early days of the NASL for you with the St. Louis Stars during the 70s, Al, does that particular style of professional soccer, the NASL days, have any resemblance to current MLS play?
I think it does. I think maybe the game now is quicker, and obviously the skill was there. I think many of the players that came over in the NASL, were a little bit beyond their youthful playing days. But we picked up so much as American players. We picked up so much from some of these players coming over, mm-hmm. But we had a little bit more, I think, longer ball to our game and not as much, you know, on the ground. But, you know, I think that was the style back then.
Yeah, it certainly was. It's dramatically changed in that capacity. We're speaking with Al Trost, by the way, former national team member, former captain of the United States national team here on the First 11. Al, for the last two friendlies against Ecuador and Chile, the national team, the overall selection was a mixture of MLS and foreign players. Is that the way to go?
Probably. I am not that familiar with it right now, but just from watching the games, I think that might be it right now. Although, you know, we're seeing so many of our good young American players come along. I just hope they keep getting the opportunity to play.
It seems to be inevitable. There are so many outlets now with MLS, U.S., United yeah. Soccer League, and the different levels yeah. there. And another topic we'd like your input on. As a former high school coach, I'd really be interested in your opinion on the, how would you term it, the stay with high school ball or play in an academy system. It's a current dynamic in youth play. What do you think?
Ooh, that is really a tough decision. You know, it kind of really depends on the individual. I'm kind of like forward to a player staying with his high school friends who he's played with, playing on that level. I don't think that's that much of a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he loses that much. I think the high school level of play is so much better now. The coaching is better, and I think in the long run, I don't think it's that much of a detriment. But mm-hmm. you know. That's just my opinion.
Al, you can certainly have your own opinion on this show. I mentioned at the outset you played on the 72 Olympic team. A little bit of history here. Because any mention of the 72 Olympic immediately conjures up the images of the murdered Israeli athletes. Were you isolated from that whole scenario, or were you aware of what was going on in the Olympic Village?
No, we were actually in a dormitory that housed our players right next to where the Israeli dormitory was. But most of us had actually left we started the soccer elimination early because of the number of teams and number of mm-hmm. games. So we were actually eliminated in the qualification round. So most of us and most of the players decided, hey, I think we're going to go out and do some sightseeing, and we got out of the village. So most of us were not really at the village when it actually occurred. So we were kind of like on the outside looking in, mm-hmm. kind of like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. So we were just at all. I mean, the security with the clamp down of the security that occurred immediately after was just unbelievable.
We wanted to get your opinion on it because you were first-hand spectator. National team-wise, your first cap, August of 1973, a 1-0 win over Poland, by the way, with you scoring the only goal. Al, was that pretty much the same Polish team that literally went on to be one of the best teams in the world at the 74 World Cup with Lotto and Gadulha and Sharmak? Were they playing against
yeah.
you?
Yes, it was. It certainly was. We were a little fortunate. I mean, we really played probably some of our best soccer in a long time as a group of national team players. But it was an event that we kind of had them on a field up, and I think it was maybe, what was it, up in Connecticut maybe? I'm trying to think. I don't recall, but it was up east, and it was on a pitch that was kind of like a little small, a little uh-huh. narrow. So we caught him at the right time, and it was a ball that was passed to me, laid off to me by Gene Geimer, and I just hit it right and got up in the upper 90.
Well, what a great memory. Bitterly disappointing that the United States didn't play in last year's World Cup. I think we can all concur on that. With the Gold Cup upcoming this summer, do you think, and you've kind of alluded to this, Al, already, is the national team seem to be on the right track to getting back onto the world stage?
Oh, I think no doubt. I wish the coaching change would occur a little bit sooner, or the determination mm-hmm. of who was going to be the coach. But, you know, in the long run, I mean, there's plenty of time. And like I said, we see so many of our young players now getting the opportunity. But I definitely think I'm real positive about them being in the next World Cup. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's amazing that when I think about the World Cup, and you made reference to me playing in the 1970s, when we tried to get qualification back in the 1970s, there were only 16 teams that qualified for the final World Cup. And there was only one team from CONCACAF. I think that changed in the 82 one. But the struggle even to get to the finals, now that they've enlarged the pool, you know, which was good. I mean, it's really opened up the World Cup to so many other nations. But I think the U.S. is going to be there for sure.
I concur with that. I mean, it seems to be inevitable. Now, of course, it seemed to be inevitable for 2018. It didn't work out.
So yeah.
Just get back after it and get a new coach. With reference to the current team, the current coach, the current system the United States is playing, or for that matter, systems all over the world, do you have a preference as to what particular system you'd like to see a team play?
Preferably, I like the four backs. After that, it's kind of like the personnel that you have. You got to see what kind of works best with your personnel. I've seen the U.S. play in all kinds of systems before. I think with four backs the basic 4-4-2, but you know, that can be changed and improvised so much, but I think it really kind of depends on the personnel that you have.
Well, we've talked about the current national team and the World Cups, but the 2018 World Cup in Russia, I mean, wasn't it one of the absolute best in recent memory?
Oh, it was great. There was great games, great goals. We had an opportunity. I still do the camps, in the summertime, especially at Maryville, and we got to see a lot of games that were on. It was great for the kids there to watch these games and how much our young kids are getting into these games. The media and the network and the television, you know, the opportunity for a lot of these young kids to see so much soccer now is great. It's just great for them.
And they're all games of really magnificent importance, not for just club ball around the world, case in point, Champions League, but just about every nation playing in every World Cup qualifier. You can see these games on a regular basis.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's great. And I tell you, you can go to your phone, you can pull up an app, and you can see who's playing all week, in every league, in every big league, and what station you can stream it on, or what cable station you can pick it up on. It's just incredible. I mean, it's great to see.
One last question before we let you go. If you can, for our listeners, describe the feeling of wearing a United States national team shirt.
There's a special pride that I guess it comes with. I'm just a little guy that grew up in North St. Louis. And when it came to representing our country on that kind of a national level, there's just to stand up there and hear your national anthem sung. It's just so special. And I wish I could put in words how special it was, but it just means whether you're playing in a friendly or whether you're playing on the World Cup stage, it's just a special, special feeling.
And there's nothing like, Al, the overall theme of World Cup, and that is it's not a city against a city. It's a nation against a nation.
That's correct. And you feel like you represent so many kids and so many programs throughout the country when you got that USA jersey on.
Well, Al Trost, listen, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it, Al. When we continue the overall qualification for World Cup, and as the team gets it, United States national team gets into Gold Cup, we'll stay in touch. We want to get your input further.
Good, Bill. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, Al, thank
and
you
I
very
guarantee
much.
We're going to be there.
Okay, thanks, Al.
All right.
And this week on the First 11, we note with extreme sorrow the recent passings of two absolute American soccer icons, Fernando Clavijo and Siggy Schmidt. First of all, Fernando. He was born in Maldonado, Uruguay, and after a life dedicated to furthering his sport here in the United States, he passed away recently on February 8th of this year at age 63. 1979, at age 22, Fernando moved to the United States. He took a job at a New Jersey restaurant. As a trialist, he signed with the New York Apollo of the then ASL. In 1983, he moved to the San Jose Earthquakes of the North American Soccer League, the then NASL. He actually may have been best known for a prolific indoor career with the New York Arrows, San Diego Sockers, Los Angeles Lasers, and the St. Louis Storm from 1989 to 92. And that's where I first met Fernando Clavijo, the consummate soccer player. In 1987, he became an American citizen and was a key player on the United States national team, winning the Gold Cup in 1991, but then played in the 1994 World Cup and was in the first 11 for two of the four games the national team played in the United States in 94. And by the way, at age 38, the oldest player on that current edition, that niche edition of the national team. He battled George Hagi of Romania at the Rose Bowl, Romario and Bebeto at Stanford Stadium on July 4th in the round of 16 in front of more than 84,000 people. He finished his career with 61 caps for the national team. He coached the New England Revolution, the Colorado Rapids, Miami FC, the United States futsal team, as well as being a part of Haiti's national team as an assistant, and likewise an assistant for Nigeria's national team. He had worked in FC Dallas as their technical director until late last summer. And for all of this, he is justifiably a member of the United States Soccer Hall of Fame. Humble, easygoing, but driven, absolutely driven to succeed with an absolutely incredible talent. He leaves behind a presence and a richness of countless personal relationships. Everybody who was involved with Fernando Clavijo at every level speaks tremendously highly of Fernando. One of the all-time greats, we honor the memory of Fernando Clavijo, and in the process, remember Martha and the entire Clavijo family. Another legend, an American soccer icon, Siggy Schmidt, passed away on Christmas Day of last year at age 65. Where to begin? Siggy was born in Tübingen, Germany, moved to the United States with his family at the tender age of 4. Played college soccer at UCLA from 1972 to 75, and then went on to coach the Bruins from 80 to 1999, winning three national championships in the process. His parents, Fritz and Doris, encouraged him to pursue business, but as we all know now, that just wasn't feasible. That wasn't in the cards at all. On to MLS and the LA Galaxy, beginning with five games, into the 1999 season. He won the 2002 MLS Cup and the CONCACAF 2000 Champions Cup, which at that particular time was uncharted territory for an MLS team. Then on to Columbus in 2006, a restructuring of the Columbus crew, eventually winning MLS Cup in 2008, led by the Galaxy's current coach, Guillermo Barros Scalotto. As the crew's announcer at that time with my partner, Dwight Burgess, this is where I really got to know Siggy Schmidt, the soccer coach and the man. Oh, by the way, prior to all this happening, Siggy coached the United States under-20 national team, and he was an assistant with Timo Lajkowski for Bora Belotinovic at the 1994 World Cup. Now, I'd like to tell you some stories about this trio. What a trio, but we only have minutes, not days. He left the crew to join the expansion Seattle Sounders in 2009 to win 4 Lamar Hunt Open Cups and a supporter shield, and eventually returned to the Galaxy in 2017 and 18. A life in soccer by the self-proclaimed nagger. I'm a chirper. I nag, he would always say, as he commented to players while they were playing, never stopping the action. He always said, and said this on a regular basis, that the player has to make decisions. This sport, Siggy would say, is a player's game. I mentioned I really got to know Siggy during his crew years, either at training at Obits, at Columbus Crew venue, either there at training, but especially at dinner on the night before game days, usually at Gordon Biersch or McCormick and Schmick's, and always over a Hefeweizen. A tremendous evaluator of young talent. His players were always prepared, either going into the pros or representing their country at whatever level of a national youth team, full national team, and all of us Every one of us became a richer person for having known Siggy Schmidt. So to his wife, Valerie, and their children, Eric, Lacey, Kurt, and Kyle, we will continue to honor the legacy of Siggy Schmidt. And please know that Siggy's passing may indeed be the end of a life, but not a relationship. And the First 11 is brought to you by Bud Light, game day's favorite light lager and famous among friends. Back here on the First 11, as we continue to talk about some of the world's games, the Champions League. The Champions League quarterfinals begin this week, and we'll discuss first leg results next week. First of all, Porto is at Anfield. Jurgen Klopp, the Liverpool coach, said, "Porto was not on my wish list," and you can see why. With the Mali forward that he has playing for Porto, Moussa Marega, he is in top form. He's going to bother any team. That's why Jurgen Klopp said he wanted no part of Porto. But no one, absolutely nobody, wants to play at Anfield. Even though Salah has been mediocre, well, that's compared to last year, Sadio Mane has been in superb form, and Porto has won in their last 18 visits to England. Maybe the goalkeeper, Iker Casillas, can still conjure up some magic. He'll be playing in his 187th Champions League game. What a staggering number. Manchester City is at Spurs at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. People are calling it the new White Hart Lane. It just opened on April 3rd. City, they may prefer the Champions League title over the possible others. That's where they seem destined. They may have to do it, however, without an informed Kevin De Bruyne. He's been injured, been off form a little bit. Maybe the difficult World Cup and the amount of work he had to do for Belgium possibly could be catching up with him. The Spurs were EPL title contenders at one time, and with Harry Kane and the Danish schemer at midfield, whoever seldom, if ever, puts a foot wrong, Christian Eriksen, they're always going to be a contender. How about this matchup? Barcelona is at Old Trafford against Manchester United. Barca, believe it or not, how is this spot? They've reached only one Champions League final in the last 7 years. Lionel Messi is on a mission. And furthermore, Barca's been bounced out in the last three quarterfinals. But again, Messi, the Argentinian, is on fire. And when asked to give an all-time first 11 in the world's game, Messi will positively be a member, no matter what era you're talking about. Even Steve Moore, our program director here at KMOX, and a huge Manchester United fan, he's going to have to admit the Red Devils squeaked by Paris Saint-Germain. A VAR gave a PK to Manchester United in the 94th minute against PSG. They go through on away. Many questions in front of Manchester United. Do Lingard and Rashford, do they run at people through the channels? Can Lukaku hold the ball up? Can Pogba continue to play like he did for France at the World Cup? Perhaps most importantly, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, now the permanent manager, can he repeat the 1999 Champions League title when they defeated Bayern Munich in one of the most astonishing endings in any final of any competition? Lastly, Juventus is at Ajax at the Johan Cruyff Arena. Ajax won three straight European Cups from 1971 to 73, led by the two Johans, Neeskens and Cruyff. Truth be told, even though they lost the 74 World Cup final to Germany, Holland was probably the best team at the Germany World Cup in 1974. Ajax took Real Madrid apart at the Bernabeu. So welcome back, Zinedine Zidane. Get a good look at that Real Madrid roster. It won't be the same next year. But Ajax, they look legit. They've played with no fear. Quick transition against Real Madrid. That was electrifying how quickly they got out. And they want revenge for the 1996 final when they lost on PKs to Juventus. But let's face it, you can't elude it. Any mention of Juventus means Cristiano Ronaldo. Did anyone really doubt that Juventus wouldn't dispatch Atletico Madrid despite trailing 2-0 going into second game? Ronaldo scored his eighth hat-trick in Champions League play. 8 hat-tricks in Champions League play. He has 63 goals in the knockout stages of Champions League. Prolific. But can he play? He's still nursing a thigh injury from his last Portugal appearance. And here is a question. Will Federico Bernardeschi play for Paulo Dybala? He had a fabulous game, Bernardeschi did, against Atletico Madrid, playing for Juventus when he was inserted into the first 11 for Dybala. Ronaldo is looking to join Clarence Seedorf as the only player to win the Champions League with three different teams. Seedorf did it with Ajax, playing with Edgar Davids and Patrick Kluivert. He also won with Real Madrid and AC Milan. Ronaldo did so with Manchester United, and Real Madrid. Is it possible he pulls it off with Juventus? But by the way, in closing about the Champions League, Real Madrid isn't in the final eight. We made that clear. Make no mistake, they'll be back. Zinedine Zidane back on board as the coach. If any team is synonymous with this competition, it's Los Galacticos. And for a generation of soccer fans, the Real Madrid Eintracht Frankfurt European Cup final of 1960 made us all, at that particular time, Real Madrid fans. For one reason, it was one of the very first games of any consequence that we had a chance to view on closed circuit, and that game made legends real for us. It was our first glimpse of Hento, Puskas, and the original maestro, Alfredo Di Stefano. We've been hooked ever since. And that game in 1960, Real Madrid wins 7-3. Di Stefano gets three. Puskas gets four at Hampden Park in Glasgow in front of 127,621 people. That's a brief summation of what's going to transpire this week with Champions League. As I mentioned, we'll get into all the results next week on the first 11. But that will do it for us this week. Thanks again to our guest, Tim Ream. Al Trost. Next week, Chris Klein, the president of the Los Angeles Galaxy, will join us. And another reminder as we get out of here that all of our content is available at kmox.com/soccer. And the first 11 is brought to you by Bud Light, Game Day's favorite light lager and famous among friends. For our executive producer, Ben Boyd, I'm Bill McDermott. We'll talk with you next week on America Sports Voice, KMOX.